This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
Within 1 hour of finding Sandra Birchmore's body, local officers told the state medical examiner there had been no foul play. Within 1 hour. 1 hour before the forensic analysis was complete. There was no forensic analysis. Before the crime scene had been thoroughly examined, before anyone identified the ligature correctly, before anyone reviewed the surveillance footage that showed Matthew Farwell entering the building the night Sandra was last seen alive, before anyone checked Sandra's phone, before anyone asked for Farwell's DNA, before anyone did any of the things you're supposed to do when a pregnant 23-year-old woman is found dead with a strap around her neck that you call a scarf, they made a call. Within 60 minutes of walking into that apartment, the officers on scene communicated to the medical examiner that they were looking at a straightforward case and that snap judgment became the foundation on which everything else was built, or more accurately, not built. Once the word went out that there was nothing suspicious, the investigation didn't just slow down, it stopped looking. That this doesn't exist anymore. This is part four of our five-part series on the Sandra Birchmore case. In parts one through three, we covered how Sandra was groomed by these officers in a police youth program, the pregnancy and the final days that preceded her end, and the forensic evidence that prosecutors say proves that she was murdered. Now we're looking at what happened after, more accurately, what didn't happen, the investigation that should have found the truth, and how it was designed at every step to avoid it. And as we do, your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. Links are in the description. The initial investigation into Sandra's death involved Canton Police, Massachusetts State Troopers, assigned to Norfolk County District Attorney Michael Morrissey's office, and the State Office of Chief Medical Examiner. Three separate entities, three opportunities to catch what was in front of them. And surprise, all three arrived at the same conclusion. Sandra did this to herself. The medical examiner ruled it self-inflicted asphyxia. Morrissey's office later released a statement saying the investigation found no evidence of foul play. That determination stood for years. Pregnant woman, a ligature around her neck that investigators called a scarf, but it was a duffel bag strap. I don't know how you don't mistake the two unless you're covering something up. A police detective on surveillance entering her building hours before her estimated time of death, and the official story was that she did this to herself. Nearly everyone in a position of authority was comfortable with that conclusion. And I think every one of those people need to have a serious look at. We can do that. That's on my list. Don't worry, we're coming for you. The failure started at the crime scene and cascaded from there. Canton police misidentified the ligature as a scarf. I don't like that word, misidentified. Lied. They lied about it. It was a duffel bag strap. Correctly identifying a ligature is one of the most basic tasks in a death investigation. The type of ligature, its width, its material, whether it's consistent with what's available in the home versus something brought in from the outside. All of this matters. They got it wrong from the very first step. They lied. The state medical examiner never visited the scene. That bears repeating. The person responsible for determining cause and manner of death did not go to the apartment where Sandra was found. But of course, you would need the actual people investigating it to give accurate information, to have the right people come and check the scene out. If they don't know to go check it out, well, then what do you do? The autopsy was conducted based on accounts from first responders, the same first responders who had already communicated no foul play within an hour. The medical examiner was working from a narrative that had been decided before she ever examined the body. The autopsy failed to recognize that the injury to Sandra's right clavicle occurred while she was still alive and matched the buckle of the knot found behind her head. That single finding, if recognized, would have blown the entire self-harm determination apart. It means the buckle struck Sandra's chest while she was alive during some kind of physical event, and then her body was repositioned into the scene investigators found. Prosecutors later stated that the evidence showed Sandra could not have died in the position in which she was found. The scene was staged. The medical examiner missed it. The broken flamingo necklace tangled in Sandra's hair left on the bedroom floor for weeks, undiscovered by investigators, until a relative found it and turned it over to the FBI. That necklace, the pink flamingo pendant Sandra wore regularly, was physical evidence of a violent struggle. It was sitting in plain sight in the apartment of a woman whose death had been classified as non-suspicious. Nobody saw it because nobody was looking. An independent audit of the Canton Police Department conducted years later by the firm Five Stones Intelligence uncovered evidence of what the auditors described as antiquated policing. The audit recommended that the department require a supervisor to review death investigation reports and that officers follow their own existing policy for photographing and sketching crime scenes. You know, basic foundational practices that apparently needed an audit to get you to do. These sort of things should never have needed to be recommended in the first place. And what a nice way of saying you're all a bunch of effing liars, in my opinion. The handling of Matthew Farwell was even more damaging. The investigators knew he was the last person seen at Sandra's building. Surveillance footage placed him there on the evening of February 1st, entering at 9:27 p.m. and leaving at 9:56 p.m. They knew he had a relationship with Sandra, and yet at no point did investigators compel a DNA sample from him. They never searched his home, never seized his electronic devices, let him keep his personal cell phone for days after Sandra's death, giving him ample time to delete text messages, clear search histories, and sanitize his digital footprint. They were not aggressive in their questioning. Federal prosecutors would later describe the treatment of Farwell received as unusual deference. Had anyone reviewed Sandra's cell phone data, they would have discovered that her phone record and its final movements while Farwell was still inside her apartment was pretty damning. That's the kind of evidence that in any competent investigation would redirect everything. It places the suspect at the scene during the moment of the victim's death. It transforms a person of interest into a primary suspect. But nobody pulled the phone data. Nobody asked the questions that the phone would have answered. Nobody went back to the surveillance footage and cross-referenced the timestamp of Farwell's visit with Sandra's phone activity to build a timeline of what happened that night. Because by the time anyone might have gotten around to looking at the phone, the case had already been categorized. And it was self-inflicted death. The file was essentially closed. The evidence that would have blown the case open sat untouched, waiting for investigators who were willing to look at it without a predetermined conclusion. The nobodies that did anything, that didn't do anything, they have names too. Oh, they have names. And like I said, we're digging. We're sharing. We're talking. And we'll make sure everyone knows your names. Federal prosecutors summarized the situation in a court filing that will follow this case into trial. At no point was Farwell seriously considered as a suspect in a homicide. Not briefly considered, not ruled out after investigation, not explored, and not dismissed based on evidence. He was simply never on the table. Matthew Farwell was a Stoughton police detective. He was the patrol officer, officers union president. He had served in the U.S. Army. He had exactly the kind of institutional standing that makes other institutional actors reluctant to ask hard questions. And in a county where the police, the prosecutors, and the medical examiner all operate within the same ecosystem, that standing carried weight. Farwell wasn't treated like a suspect because the people investigating Sandra's death saw a colleague, not a perpetrator. Meanwhile, Sandra was the opposite of credible in the eyes of the system. She was a 23-year-old woman with a documented history of emotional challenges. She'd been hospitalized once briefly after a family argument, eventually evaluated and released the same day. She had a history of that. to people not looking carefully could be used to explain away her death. The power imbalance that defined Sandra's relationship with Farwell in life didn't end when she died. It carried right through the investigation. His word was accepted at face value. Her story was never seriously examined. His credibility was assumed. Hers was never given a chance. The internal affairs investigation didn't happen until 2022, a full 19 months after Sandra was found deceased. And in that investigation conducted by then Deputy Chief Brian Holmes, not the original death inquiry that first publicly revealed the S relationship between Sandra and the officers, the internal affairs report concluded that Matthew Farwell, William Farwell, and Robert Devine all had inappropriate relationships with Sandra. It was the first time the public learned the scope of what had happened inside the Stoughton Police Department. And still, even after those revelations, no criminal charges followed them to the state. The Norfolk County DA's office did not prosecute. Sandra's family refused to accept what the system told them from the very beginning. Her relatives said she was not looking at ending it at the time of her death. She was looking forward to being a mother. She was making plans. She was texting friends about baby supplies and talking about the future. The woman her family knew did not match the narrative being constructed by people who never bothered to look past the surface and had every incentive not to. Her estate filed a wrongful death lawsuit in December of 2022, naming Matthew Farwell, William Farwell, Robert Devine of the town of Stoughton as defendants. And then the family did something that the state should have done from the start. They hired an independent forensic expert, Dr. Michael Baden, a veteran forensic pathologist known for handling high-profile cases, reviewed Sandra's autopsy report. At the request of her estate, he conducted her death, or concluded her death was a homicide, a fractured right hyoid bone, supported the finding, along with other physical evidence the original investigation overlooked. Separately, the FBI brought in Dr. William Smock, a physician specializing in forensic medicine who had previously testified in the trial of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin. Smock reached the same conclusion, homicide by strangulation. He pointed to the pattern imprint on Sandra's chest, the nasal abrasions consistent with suffocation, and the broken necklace as indicators of violence. Two independent experts, neither of whom had any connection to Norfolk County or the Stoughton Police Department, both looked at the same case and said, the state got it wrong. Surprise, you know, people who are close to the department, close to the people who have a vested interest in covering this up, suddenly everything looks different. I wonder why that is. The system didn't correct itself. Sandra's family forced the correction. They spent years demanding an answer that should have been obvious to anyone paying attention. They held monthly vigils. They organized standouts in Stoughton and Canton. They built a coalition of supporters. They kept Sandra's name in the public conversation long after the institutions responsible for her justice had moved on. The institutional response has been a study in deflection. The state medical examiner's office said its finding was based on the evidence available at the time. As of the most recent public statements, the office has not changed its ruling. Sandra Birchmore's death certificate still lists her manner of death as what the state originally determined, even though she's been federally indicted as a homicide victim. Canton police said they don't determine cause and manner of death. Everyone points at someone else. Nobody owns the failure. Norfolk County DA Michael Morrissey announced in January 26 that he would not seek re-election after 15 years. His handling of the Birchmore case alongside the Karen Reed prosecution that ended with acquittals on the most serious charges gutted public confidence in his office. Multiple candidates are now running for his seat, several explicitly citing Birchmore and Reed as evidence of systematic dysfunction. Sandra's family has endorsed Adam Dietich, a former federal prosecutor who directed the federal probe into Morrissey's handling of the Reed case. Her family members said Morrissey's office failed to deliver justice when it mattered most. That phrase could serve as the epitaph for the entire state-level investigation into Sandra's death. The Birchmore case didn't just expose a murder. It exposed the infrastructure that allowed a murder to be buried. Every layer of the system, from the officers on the scene to the medical examiner, to the district attorney's office, operated in a way that protected the person who allegedly committed the crime and dismissed the person who was killed. Whether that was conscious coordination or the natural outcome of a system that reflexively protects its own is a question that may never be definitively answered. But the result is identical either way. Sandra Birchmore deserved an investigation that treated her death and gave it the gravity it warranted. Instead, she got one that treated a police detective's comfort as more important than a dead woman's truth. In part five, coming up, the final chapter of this series, we cover the reckoning. The FBI arrests, the federal charges, the defense team's aggressive maneuvering, the political fallout that has reshaped Norfolk County, and the family that never stopped fighting. Trial begins in October of 26. We'll be here to bring it to you. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. And be sure to press subscribe so you don't miss any of our coverage of this case. I look forward to continuing our conversation there in the comment section. Until then, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers Podcast.